This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. On Friday, President Obama told Attorney General Eric Holder to review how the U.S. carries out the death penalty after a botched execution in Oklahoma last week that Obama called deeply disturbing. Clayton Lockett was reportedly given a cocktail of three drugs and writhed and groaned on the gurney for 43 minutes before dying of a heart attack. States have used hangings and electrocutions, lethal gas, even firing squads, until recent years, with states now relying on lethal injections to execute prisoners. The problem is that it's difficult to obtain the reliable drugs, and that means states are experimenting with new combinations. Today, Radio Times, does lethal injection satisfy the Eighth Amendment's protections against cruel and unusual punishment? And joining us is Megan McCracken. She's the Eighth Amendment Resource Counsel at the University of California School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic. And she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Megan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. How long have states largely been relying on lethal injection to administer the death penalty?
It has been the primary form of execution in the modern era of the death penalty, so since the late 70s.
And I listed all the various ways that the death penalty has been carried out. Is lethal injections, has it been seen as being either more medical, more scientific, more humane, safer?
Oh, there's certainly been, as you pointed out, sort of a movement through different methods. And certainly the move towards lethal injection was perceived as more medicalized, perhaps, you know, hopefully safer, and a more, a cleaner looking way to carry out executions. And so, you know, and the Supreme Court has talked about evolving standards of decency as they apply to the Eighth Amendment, and that states are trying to improve their procedures over time. And so that is, lethal injection is sort of a step in that trajectory.
But as you wrote, you had a piece in the New York Times with a co-author. As you wrote, it's been harder and harder for states to get the kinds of drugs that have been traditionally used to carry out the death penalty, in part of what's happening in this country, but also in part of what's been happening in some European countries. Help us understand what was going on, or what has been going on.
Sure. So since 2001, at least, and perhaps earlier, but we know since 2001, the large pharmaceutical companies that make the drugs that are used in executions, they have been contacting the states, both the departments of corrections and the governors, and saying, please don't use our products in your executions.
And why not?
Now, I can't really speak for them directly, but I know what their letters and press releases say. And they say, we make our products, we make our drugs to help people, to heal people, to treat sickness. We don't want our products associated with and used in executions. And over time, you know, they've sent numerous letters, and the states have ignored them. More recently, the pharmaceutical companies have put in place distribution restrictions to prevent departments of corrections from obtaining their drugs to use in executions. And so that's making it very difficult for the departments of corrections to get the drugs or find the drugs they want. You know, I do want to clarify, sometimes people will say that there are shortages of these drugs. That's not accurate. The drugs are widely available for medical use. It's that the pharmaceutical companies don't want their products used in executions.
And some states have turned to, or had turned in the past to Europe to provide some of these drugs, but that also looks like has been helping to create this situation we're talking about.
That's right. So the EU forbids the death penalty. They don't have the death penalty in the EU, and it actually violates their laws for the pharmaceutical companies based in the EU to provide drugs for executions, even if the executions are here. So the EU has put in place some export controls and some laws basically designed to protect their pharmaceutical companies from violating the law. But that has, so that's one aspect of it, and that has, I suppose, contributed to the difficulty of obtaining the drugs. The other aspect of it is that when some states in our, you know, here try to import unapproved drugs into the country to use in executions, the federal courts made perfectly clear that the FDA could not allow those drugs into the country. That violates our Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act.
And some states have been turning to these compounding companies, I guess, to create the drugs to use to carry out an execution.
That's right. So compounding pharmacies The traditional role of compounding pharmacies is to mix up small batches of drugs to order. And they serve a vital function in medical care. You know, if a patient has an allergy or an inability to take the regular form of a medication, a compounding pharmacy will mix up for them the drug, either without that additive or in the form that they're able to take, maybe a liquid instead of a pill, you know, that sort of issue. So it's a vital function. But when pentobarbital, the brand name Nembutal, became unavailable to the Departments of Corrections, we saw this turn to compounding pharmacies to get compounded pentobarbital. And in this context, it's much more troubling. It's not, you know, compounded products are not FDA approved.
Well, I was just going to say there's less oversight of these.
There's much less oversight of the products. And of course, you know, when you are a patient with a specialized need, then it's an important decision and it's important risk to take because you need the medicine. But on a larger scale, you know, compounded products carry less certainty that they are what they purport to be and that they're going to be safe and effective. And we have seen some of the outcomes of that. We saw the fungal meningitis outbreak that killed a lot of people and sickened others. In the past, we saw a team of polo ponies who all died after receiving compounded what were supposed to be compounded vitamin injections. So it is a problem, and it also, to the extent that compounding pharmacies are regulated, they're regulated by state law, and it seems pretty clear that Departments of Corrections violate those state regulatory laws when they go to compounding pharmacies to get the drugs. You know, they don't have doctor-patient relationships, they don't have prescriptions, those types of issues are not met.
So do we know with Clayton Lockett, who was given some drugs last week in order to be put to death, do we know what drugs he was given?
We know the names of the drugs, yes. So his execution was carried out with a three-drug formula. The first drug was midazolam, which is a benzodiazepine. The second drug was a paralytic agent, vecuronium bromide. And the third drug was concentrated potassium chloride, which stops the heart. Those drugs were not, to our understanding, those drugs were not compounded products. They were manufactured products.
And is there any, I mean, what we're talking about, and it's been described as a botched execution, and it took him 43 minutes to die and apparently died of the heart attack, which I guess was as a result of the third drug that he was given. So what do you take away from this particular case?
There is a lot to take away from this case, unfortunately. First, you know, you were asking about the drugs before, and it's important to realize that while we know the names of the drugs and that the Oklahoma Department of Corrections has stated that the drugs were manufactured, they refuse to reveal the actual manufacturer of the drugs and sort of the information that a court and the public would need to actually evaluate if these drugs were going to be effective for this purpose. The Department of Corrections kept that information secret and refused to turn it over. And then secondly, you know, they're sort of slowly trickling out information about what happened in Mr. Lockett's execution. And so at the end of last week, the director of the Department of Corrections, Mr. Patton, sent out a letter revealing that the Department of Corrections had set what's called a femoral line, meaning that the IV that was delivering the drugs to Mr. Lockett was set in his femoral vein, which is in the groin. Based on the timeline that the state sent out about the execution, although we don't know what happened, and I have to, you know, I have to kind of couch every answer with we don't know and we will not know what happened unless and until there is a thorough and truly independent investigation. If we guess and sort of make suppositions based on this timeline, it looks like that IV was never properly set in Mr. Lockett's femoral vein. So it looks as if my guess is that the drugs were pushed into his flesh, and then the absorption of those drugs is going to take much, much longer.
Which, of course, raises questions that we don't know the answer to, which is the training of the people to carry out this execution, competence, professionalism. I mean, all the questions that would be associated with a botched execution.
That's exactly right. There was a real rush in Oklahoma to carry out this execution. There was a rush to change to the new current protocol they have in place in Oklahoma, and then a rush to really carry out this execution, and the execution that was scheduled but has now been postponed to happen 2 hours after Mr. Lockett's execution. And so there are, exactly what you said, very significant questions about the training, qualifications, and competency of the execution team, on top of all the questions related to these three drugs because this is a brand new, never used before combination of drugs at these doses.
Well, as we know, people are can not everybody, but specific people can come and watch an execution. Journalists have done that. There was a journalist actually who was either blogging or tweeting and was observing what was going on. And then at one point, the curtain is closed.
That's right.
And what I get from what you're saying is that there's just a lot of secrecy or privacy or lack of transparency when it comes to what exactly is going on with an execution.
Yes, absolutely. There was a lot of secrecy surrounding Mr. Lockett's execution long before it ever started. And then, as you say, they did close the curtain. And so the witnesses who were there were unable to see what happened from the time when they realized that Mr. Lockett was conscious until the time they declared he was dead, which was 27 minutes, the curtain was closed. And so the witnesses, you know, they have no idea what happened. The journalists and the official witnesses, no one was able to see what was going on. It's unclear whether the Department of Corrections and the execution team was trying to resuscitate Mr. Lockett at that point, or were they taking additional steps trying to execute him? It's very unclear.
Do we have a right to know? Does the American public have a right to know what happened in this case and other cases?
I would say that we do, and I would say we have an interest in knowing. You know, the state has a responsibility to carry out all criminal sanctions, but including the death penalty. They have a responsibility to carry it out in the right way, in a way that comports with the Constitution and with the laws. And so this is really a question of what does it take for the states to be able to do this the right way in compliance with the Constitution. And with so much secrecy, without oversight and transparency, this is a predictable consequence.
We're almost up on a break here, but and I've read this before, and I've done this with animals, with pets that I've had, where you go when they're on their last legs, and you go to the vet, and they put them to sleep, and I've been there a bunch of times. It happens in a second. I mean, within a second, they are dead. Why is it so hard to execute somebody?
It's a really good question, and I've been there too, and it really is a serene and very humane process when you're putting a pet down at your veterinary's office. There's a lot of differences. When you are with a veterinary process, usually the veterinarian or the tech is hands-on next to your pet, injecting the drugs, him or herself, very professionally, making sure that what happens is happening the right way. In an execution, you have two separate rooms. The condemned prisoner is usually alone or maybe with a spiritual advisor or a prison person in one room, on a gurney with IVs somewhere, usually in the peripheral veins in the arms, but in this case in the groin. And then there are long IV tubes that run across the room through a hole in the wall into the other room, which is closed behind curtains, completely secret, and the drugs are being pushed from that room through all of this IV tubing. And so there's just a lot of distance, and that can make the procedure much more difficult.
And that's Megan McCracken, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about what has been described as the botched execution of Clayton Lockett last week. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We have a guest waiting in the wings, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at wistar.org.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive DBA.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the execution of Clayton Lockett last week in Oklahoma, which has raised a host of questions about lethal injection, about cruel and unusual punishment, and the death penalty itself. Megan McCracken is an attorney with the University of California School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic. And joining us now is Michael Mannheimer, visiting professor at Penn State University's Dickinson College of Law, professor of law at the Salmon P. Chase College of Law at Northern Kentucky University. And Michael Mannheimer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Does this case that we've been talking about, does that violate the Constitution protection of involving cruel and unusual punishment?
Well, I don't think so. Well, the starting point for that question is the court's 2008 decision in Bays versus Reese. And I apologize if you covered some of this with Megan already. I'm not sure if you've discussed this already, but the court in Bays versus Reese essentially said that there are going to be accidents. Accidents will happen sometimes, and the question is there a substantial risk of an accident occurring so that the condemned prisoner will experience severe pain? And unless there's a substantial risk, then, these lethal injection protocols don't violate the Constitution. So a one-off situation where there is a mistake or there is an accident or there is a botched execution doesn't necessarily violate the Eighth Amendment. If, on the other hand, we get a series of these types of things and the states continue to use the same protocols in the face of, these continuing accidents, then I could see the court saying, well, now you've got to do something. You've got to change your protocol.
Well, what we were talking with Megan about is the difficulty that some states are experiencing trying to get the correct drugs or the right kind of dosage of drugs for executions, and also the level of secrecy, if I can use that word, in that there's so much that we don't know about what goes on. Does that raise some questions for you?
Taking that last point first, the secrecy issue. It's interesting that until the mid-19th century, executions were public, so everybody could see, and it was, at that time it was typically a hanging, so everybody could see what was going on. We started moving executions indoors and under cover of night starting in the mid-19th century, in part because of the abolitionist movement, and states felt that if people actually continued to see executions, they would become more sympathetic to the condemned prisoner, and there'd be a greater move toward abolition. So, and the last public execution in this country, I think, was 1936. So the reason, or at least a large part of the reason for the secrecy is so that the public is not aware of what goes on and doesn't become more sympathetic to the condemned prisoner. In terms of the...
You know what? Hold on to that thought only because I want to get Megan McCracken back in on the conversation. I'd be curious, do you see it that way, the idea that if people witness these executions, there would be more sympathy for the person being executed? I mean, we can't run that experiment, but from what you know about the death penalty.
Right. I don't know. I'm not a reader of tea leaves. And so I can't really say what the public in general would think. I know that the witnesses to Mr. Lockett's execution were deeply disturbed by what they saw and what they did not see. you know, what they were prevented from seeing. And I do have a different perspective on Mr. Lockett's execution with respect to whether or not it violated the Eighth Amendment. You know, I think it's clear that what happened to Mr. Lockett fell far short of the Eighth Amendment protections, even under Bays v. Reese, for two reasons. One is that, you know, Bays v. Reese does talk about a substantial risk of serious harm.
This is the 2008.
Yes, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
And I think here, where Oklahoma was rushing to implement a new protocol with a new set of drugs at doses that had never been used before, you know, that does present a substantial risk. And if you have an execution team that's not prepared to set the type of IV that they were setting in the femoral vein, that does present a substantial risk. Moreover, the Supreme Court acknowledged that if the first drug in a three-drug protocol fails to deeply anesthetize the prisoner, which is exactly the failure that happened here, then the prisoner would suffer a torturous, inhumane execution in violation of the Eighth Amendment because he would be conscious, paralyzed, and then suffer the burning of potassium chloride through his veins and then cardiac arrest.
But I guess, and this is such a weird question, but if we have the death penalty, then should it be perfect? And by that I mean, you know, do we allow for any mistakes or botched executions? I'm looking at you, Megan, and then I'll get you in on it, Michael.
Right. You know, the Supreme Court has acknowledged that it can't be perfect, that, like Mr. Manheimer said, that accidents are going to happen. There are going to be one-offs. Things are not always going to be perfect. But that's far different from a situation where the procedures are cloaked in secrecy. There's a rush to execute. An unqualified, incompetent team, experimental drug combinations and doses. You know, all of these issues, I think, are a far cry from an unpredictable. This was very predictable, and that's different from an unpredictable accident.
Michael Manheimer, you want to add to that or respond?
Yeah, I tend to disagree. I mean, this only happened a week ago, and we certainly don't have the full story yet, and I'm not sure we ever will. But from the initial accounts, it sounds as if the problem with the execution had nothing to do with the drugs themselves that were being used. And that was the big controversy leading up to this execution, that these drugs were untested, they wouldn't disclose where they were from. And yet, it appears that the problem with the execution had to do with the sighting of the IV, or the fact, perhaps, that the drugs were injected too quickly. So it didn't really have anything, as far as I can tell, to do with the nature of the drugs, but instead it had to do with how the drugs were injected.
Let me get a caller on who called us up pretty quickly after we started our conversation here, and this is Sandra from Wilmington, Delaware. Sandra, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call, and
you're
thank you so much for bringing attention to this issue.
Sure.
This is an issue that I've been intimately acquainted with for some time through my studies and also through witnessing the execution of my friend Brian Steckel in my state of Delaware in 2005. By the measures of many, was a botched execution. Most of the inmates are executed are deemed announced dead at 12:05, and he was not pronounced dead until 12:21. After he made his final statement, the warden was standing over him. He closed his eyes and said, I'm ready for my, he looked at me and his cousin and his attorney and said, I'm ready for my journey to begin. Closed his eyes and we held our breath. And a minute passed before he opened his eyes and looked up and said, why is this taking so long? At the warden, he did it again, two times. He kept closing his eyes. Another time he looked at the warden and he said, are you okay? As if the warden, whose back was to us, I couldn't see his face, was flushed because he was surprised at the response. And I'm here to tell all of your listeners that what we tend to think in the society is a very clinical, easy way of somebody slipping to death is not at all what you might imagine. His body revolted and made lots of, even though his extremities were tied down, he made a great deal of movement and appeared to be very much in pain. And I'm very disturbed by the secrecy, and I appreciate you bringing attention to that. Delaware's execution protocol is, when you look it up online, is almost all redacted. From the time they leave the death chamber, the secure housing unit to go to the death house, a great deal of it is redacted. And as a tax-paying citizen of my state, my tax dollars are being used to commit a homicide, which is defined as a killing of one person by another, and it's also written under cause of death of inmates, a state-sanctioned homicide, I think that we deserve to know exactly what's happening in that death chamber.
Well, Sandra, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Michael, let me toss that to you for a reaction. I mean, she has concluded, and it sounded like it was a friend of hers who was executed, that this is a homicide, and she obviously opposes it and says that perhaps there are more problems than we know of because we don't really know what's going on.
Yeah, it sounded like that execution took longer than it should have. I think the typical execution takes between 8 and 13 minutes from the beginning of the injection of the drugs. But again, I agree with the caller that the secrecy is a problem. I mean, in some states, notably Kentucky, where I typically teach, the lethal injection protocol was subject to a notice and comment period by the public. The public got to read exactly what they were going to do and to comment on it. And I think that that's really the way to go. And I would even take a step further. This may sound sort of novel, but have the executions broadcast, have them taped, and people can actually see what goes on. And, you know, the whole idea behind the Eighth Amendment, the Supreme Court has said, is that it kind of encompasses the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. And we as a public really can't, decide what that means, you know, what evolving standards of decency we're going to adopt as a society unless we actually know what's going on. So I'm all in favor of disclosure and this, you know, lifting this veil of secrecy.
Megan, let me put something else to you. The American Medical Association, you know, opposes the involvement of physicians in executions. Apparently, the American Society of Anesthesiologists also, as I understand it, and doing some homework for today's show, also oppose the use of anesthesiologists in the carrying out of a death penalty. Do you think that raises questions then about the competence and professionalism of those who are carrying out the death penalty?
Sure. All of the medical associations, including nurses associations and the association for the EMTs, the paramedics, they all oppose the participation of their members in executions. And that's an ethical guideline.
No harm, right? I mean, the sort of Hippocratic oath.
Right. It's an outgrowth of the Hippocratic oath. But it's also an ethical guideline, meaning that, you know, these medical professionals still have to make their own decisions about participation. And the reality is that we do see participation by medical experts, EMTs, nurses, military corpsmen, and doctors, to varying degrees all across the country. And so in some places, there's no participation by medical professionals. And then in other places, there's a doctor involved in overseeing the procedure and, you know, hands-on involved. And so I think, you know, there's sort of a misperception that doctors cannot and therefore do not participate, whereas in reality they do participate. And there's really, you know, there's just these guidelines, you know, obviously advising them not to. You know, the states have chosen to medicalize to some extent this procedure, and so it's then a problem that they have to deal with.
And that's Megan McCracken. Again, she's an attorney with the University of California School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic. Also with us, Michael Manheimer. He's a visiting professor at Penn State University's Dickinson College of Law. And we are talking about the death penalty in this hour of Radio Times and talking about the execution last week of Clayton Lockett. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Dean from Chester County to join us. Dean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, well, I was calling because I've been a veterinarian for 35 years, and when you made the comment earlier about the fact that really euthanasia in animals is a very, very well-established protocol. I mean, animals are animals. I mean, there's no difference, really, fundamentally. Euthanizing a human and euthanizing any other more advanced mammal. And the techniques that are used and the competence that's shown in these executions is just bungled. The drugs alone, you would net, like if you take, for example, in a research institution, you would absolutely not be allowed to euthanize a research animal with any combination of drugs that looks anything like that that they're using in humans. That's a terrible combination of drugs for humane euthanasia of an animal. Why would they think it's going to work in a human? I have no idea.
Well, Dina, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, Michael, let me toss that to you. This is something that Megan and I were talking about before you joined our conversation about the fact that veterinarians seem to be able to carry out euthanasia in a pretty reliably humane way.
Yeah, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that veterinarians tend to use a single dose of a sedative. And that seemed to be the way the states were turning, starting in about 2010, in terms of executions. Instead of using a three-drug protocol, which is what every state had used back in 2008, some states, notably Ohio, were switching to a one-drug protocol, which was, you know, would be just a massive dose of the first drug of what is typically a three-drug protocol, the sedative, either pentobarbital or sodium thiopental. And in Ohio, that seemed to do the trick. The executions went off without a hitch, I would say. I guess the problem is that states have now started to run out of the pentobarbital, which is the drug that they've switched to,
right.
Had to improvise. And now they're using midazolam, or some of them are using midazolam, and I'm not certain whether that's appropriate for a one drug protocol execution.
We're almost coming up on a break here. And let me toss this to you, Megan McCracken. Does it change our conversation? And people that support the death penalty, and frankly, we're happy that Clayton Lockett suffered, is because the crime he committed was absolutely horrible. A woman was murdered, and then apparently some accomplices of his buried her alive. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible crime that was committed. And people that seem to think, you know, they're happy that he suffered, is that you made your victim suffer. We're happy the state made you suffer. How do you respond to something like that?
Right. I appreciate the question, and I think it's an important issue to address. The punishment that was handed down to Mr. Lockett and other prisoners who are condemned to death is that they lose their life, not that they're tortured to death or that there's pain and suffering added on top of that. Losing one's life is the most serious. It's the ultimate punishment the states can impose. And the states have a responsibility to carry out that punishment in a way that complies with the Constitution and complies with the laws. And it's important as a matter of good government that they do so, that they're able to do so, that they do so with transparency. I agree completely with everything Mr. Mannheimer was saying about openness and transparency. And so that really is simply a responsibility that falls upon the states. And I think we have to be concerned as citizens when we see signs that the state is not able to carry out these sentences in our names, in a way that complies either with the laws and or the Constitution.
And just to read the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Michael Mannheimer, can you stay with us?
Sure.
Excellent. And we have a third guest who's waiting in the wings. He'll be joining us as well. We are talking about the death penalty, the execution last week of Clayton Lockett, and the questions that it raises about the death penalty. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The latest healthcare developments.
How what happens in Washington affects you.
How world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the execution last week of Clayton Lockett and the questions that his botched execution, as it is called, the questions it raises about lethal injection, cruel and unusual punishment, and the death penalty itself. We've got a lot of callers that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscow-Wayne. Joining us now is Frank Newport, and Frank is the editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll, past president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Marty.
So where does the majority of the American people stand on the death penalty?
They continue to support it, the majority. The numbers have changed over time. We first asked a question about the death penalty back in 1935-36, believe it or not. Not wow. Me, but Gallup. And 59% supported the death penalty for a person convicted of murder. That's the way we asked it back then. The numbers have vacillated significantly. In the 60s, when there were no executions, the percentage actually fell below a majority. But once execution started up again in the 70s, support rose as high as 80% who favored it in 1992, 1993, in that range, and it's been coming down since. But our latest surveys show that about 60% of Americans support it, 35% are opposed. And in a separate question, we say, is the death penalty morally acceptable, which we put in a list of a lot of other things, whether they're morally acceptable or not. And we find about the same percentage, 62% of Americans say the death penalty is morally acceptable.
And do you see big differences along religious lines or racial lines or age or gender? I'm thinking of all the various constituencies in this country.
Yes, there are differences, big differences by racial lines. Non-whites, in particular African-Americans, are significantly less likely to favor the death penalty. And there are significant political and ideological differences, one of the other big cleavages in the data. If you're a Democrat or a liberal, you're much less likely to support the death penalty than if you're a Republican or if you are a conservative. And there are regional differences as well. The majority of executions take place in the South, of course, as we all know from data that are available from people who track those things, and support is higher in the South than elsewhere.
And does news drive public opinion? We've been talking about Clayton Lockett, and this is an execution that has gotten a lot of attention in the last week. Do you think that will drive public opinion one way or the other?
You know, that's a good question, and I haven't seen any other poll that has updated these measures since that news about what happened in Oklahoma became prominent in what people were seeing and hearing and reading about, so we don't know. We do know that in other questions that have been asked, majority of Americans agree on a different dimension, that innocent people are sometimes put to death in the death penalty, given the death penalty, and yet still they support the death penalty. Point two is, when we ask people why they support the death penalty, by far the most dominant reason is an eye for an eye and revenge. They deserve it, and so it seems like the fact that it was took 45 minutes or whatever for the person to die who was being executed may not affect them so much, because the people are saying in general they deserve it. Also, a number of years ago, about 10 years ago, I did find a question where we had asked Do you favor lethal injection or not? Right. And the question said lethal injection of death row prisoners represents cruel and unusual punishment that shouldn't be permitted. But given that alternative, 75% said, no, we favor lethal injection. Now, that was 10 years ago, so attitudes may have changed. So we don't know. It's an empirical question whether attitudes are going to change now. But I think we're on a downward slope of support, and it'll probably continue to go down, but I wouldn't expect it's going to be affected dramatically.
Well, Frank Newport, we appreciate the fact that you joined us on Radio Times once again. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And he's editor-in-chief of Gallup, again, past president of the American Association of Public Opinion Research. And staying with us for the rest of the hour, Megan McCracken, the Eighth Amendment Resource Counsel at the University of California's Law School, the Death Penalty Clinic. Also with us, Michael Mannheimer, visiting professor at Penn State University's Dickinson College of Law. And he's also a scholar of criminal procedure, sentencing, and death penalty law. And his work has examined cruel and unusual punishments, the clause of the Eighth Amendment. We've got a lot of callers who want to join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Another question, though, I'm going to toss it first to you, Megan, and then to you, Michael, then we'll get to our callers. And in states where there is a death penalty, and we should say Pennsylvania is one of those states, if a jury is told that someone convicted is going to get life without parole, I mean, they will never, ever, ever get out of prison. Does that change sentencing at all, Megan?
Do we know? I am sure someone knows. I don't think I'm the best person to answer that question, and maybe Mr. Mannheimer can address it better. But my understanding is, based on Gallup polls, that when the question is asked, do you support the death penalty if the alternative is life without the possibility of parole, then the support for the death penalty actually falls. But in terms of the effect on a jury, I think I have to pass on that question.
Fair enough. Michael, do you want to take that?
Yeah, there's a line of case law, in fact, where in various cases the prosecution has fought tooth and nail to keep from the jury, you know, an accurate description of what life without parole really means, because the prosecution knows that when jurors actually understand that life without parole means life without parole, it's much less likely that they are going to impose the death penalty. Juries tend to feel, it seems, and just looking at data from the Capital Jury Project and other places, jurors tend to feel, we need to make sure this person, you know, never gets out. And if they believe that life without parole doesn't really mean life without parole, they'll be much more in favor of putting the person to death. There's a sense that when we say life in prison, jurors, you know, harken back to the 60s and 70s when life didn't really mean life. But in the last 20 years or so, at least, we've changed our sentencing laws so that life without parole actually means life without parole, and jurors sometimes don't believe that. They have to be specifically instructed that that's what it means, and prosecutors are resistant to giving them that instruction, even in the face of a jury will come back with a note that says, does life without parole mean that he'll never get out? And prosecutors don't want judges to answer that question, yes.
Interesting. Let me get to Diane from Reading, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. Diane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. I have a question. Is it feasible to have the death penalty applied only to prisoners who commit the most heinous of crimes? I'm thinking of Jeffrey Dahmer and Manson. I mean, Rich spent millions. I know Dahmer's dead, but if he hadn't been murdered, he would pay millions of dollars to keep these two people alive. That money could be used to better prison programs, ties into poverty, people below poverty levels. And I just wonder if that would be a feasible plan, because part of me agrees it should be abolished, but I don't like paying for folks like Nancy.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I think the question is it more expensive to keep someone in prison for their entire life, or is it more expensive to execute them? Again, I'm looking at you, Megan.
It's a good question, and I thank you to the caller. Having the death penalty is more expensive than sentencing a prisoner to life without parole. Again, I'm sure Mr. Mannheimer can give
flesh
more
that out.
Flesh this out for me. But I believe that is the case.
Is that the case, Michael Manheimer?
I haven't studied the question in depth, but that's pretty much what everybody says. The cost studies all show that the death penalty is more expensive. For one thing, it's more expensive to keep someone on death row than in the general prison population because you have to have a higher guard to inmate ratio. It's more expensive because there are more appeals, so it takes more legal work, it takes more judicial time, it takes more prosecutorial time. It takes more defense counsel work, and the state is typically paying for the defense counsel as well as for the prosecutors. It costs more on the front end because the trial takes longer. The jury selection process in a capital case is much more extensive. Jury selection can take several weeks in a capital case, whereas in a typical felony case, jury selection can be done in an afternoon. The sentencing hearing entails a lot more work for defense counsel because defense counsel have to dig up all the mitigating evidence that they can find. So it's almost like having a second trial. So all of these things generate a lot of costs. I think there's general agreement that the death penalty is more expensive than life without parole.
Diane, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Michael, let me go back to you and something that you talked about, the 60s, 70s, maybe even into the 80s. The violent crime rate and even the homicide rate in this country has gone down pretty dramatically in the last couple of decades. Do I have that right?
Yeah, since about 92 or 93, it started going down. Then it leveled off just a few years ago, and it sort of leveled off, plateaued.
Do you think that changes public opinion at all? And I'm also thinking about the number of exonerated people who were on death row, and it turns out that they were wrongfully committed. Do you think in any way that has people sort of rethinking what we do to the most violent criminals in the country?
I think it's more the latter. The prospect of executing an innocent person, which wasn't perhaps fully understood before the early 1990s, I think is now much more better understood by the layperson because of the advent of DNA evidence and a whole slew of exonerations that have occurred, both of death row inmates and prisoners serving prison terms. And I think that is the biggest thing that is driving that number that Mr. Newport talked about down to the level that it is now. I don't know if the general decline in violent crime itself has done anything to those numbers. If anything, when we're on a 24-hour news cycle and you pretty much hear about every single violent crime in your community that occurs, I don't think the layperson even knows that violent crime has gone down in the last 20, 25 years.
It just doesn't feel that way to them when they get that barrage of news. And, Megan, I mean, we're in a state, Pennsylvania, that has a death penalty. I don't know the last time that it was carried out, but it certainly has been years. When you look at the country, broadly speaking, do we find executions happening in certain parts of the country as opposed to others? Michael talked about the South more likely to carry out a death penalty than the North, for instance. But even beyond that?
Yes, right. The South carries out, the Southern states, I guess I should say, carry out more executions than the Northern states. And there are certain states that are particularly active. And that can change over time, but there are also some states that are always active. Texas is always a very active state. Ohio, which is not in the South, is a very active state, especially lately.
Oklahoma, I guess.
Oklahoma is certainly active. And obviously population differences between the states, percentage-wise, a state can be more active than it is total number-wise. But Oklahoma, Alabama, Georgia, these states tend to remain active. But Texas and Ohio are sort of out in front right now.
Let me get John from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, 2 points I'd like to make. First was the comment about 18 to 13 minutes for start to finish for lethal injection. I can't help but think what's crueler, lethal injection or just letting them decide how they wish to be dispatched? You know, as offensive as we may find a firing squad or hanging, you know, what's quicker to the individual who's undergoing this? And a second comment, decreasing rate of homicides, does that take into fact the improvement of medical technology to bring victims back from the brink of death? I mean, how many shooting victims are out there?
That's a fair question, John. No, and actually, only because I'm looking at the clock, let's take your first question, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Michael Manheimer, do you want to take that?
And that's a very good point, that latter point, that about the increase in medical technology. I don't think that has played a big role in this latest decline in violent crime. If I recall correctly, violent crime has decreased pretty much across the board. And if it were a matter simply of medical technology improving so much, you would expect, you know, a declining rate of homicide but an increasing rate of aggravated assault or attempted murder. And I don't believe those rates have gone up. In prior periods of history, that has been
right.
The case.
And he was saying, you know, maybe since we're talking about the death penalty, maybe a firing squad is a more humane, quicker way to be executed. I hate to toss that to you at the very end of the show, Michael, but that's what our caller's question was about.
Well, you know, there's no foolproof way with hanging. You know, there's a lot of mistakes with hanging because it depends a lot on the length of the rope and the weight of the prisoner. It's a very intricate science. With firing squads, no matter how good the shooters are, they can miss the heart, and the person can spend several minutes bleeding to death. You know, ironically, probably the best or most painless ways of execution are the ones that we would consider the most ghastly, the guillotine.
Wow.
Or shooting someone in the back of the head at close range. I mean, we would never do something like that, but because of the, you know, there's a trade-off between painlessness and what I would call, you know, the aesthetics of the execution. And we prefer to have the aesthetics rather than the painlessness.
Well, on that note, I appreciate the fact that you both joined us today in Radio Times. Michael Manheimer, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
A pleasure to have you on as well. A very important conversation to have. Megan McCracken, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this show, and you can also carry on the conversation we just had on the radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. Sophie Reed producing today's shows. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.